It's the morning show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. I'm really excited right now because I finally get to talk with Kevin McKinley. As listeners know, Kevin is a financial planner and a managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And he joins us every Tuesday from WPR studio in Eau Claire to help you with your financial planning. So welcome, Kevin.
Hello. Let me get this right just a second. Carrie.
Yeah, think Carrie Fisher. That's how people, or Carrie the movie. That's how people remember my name. So we're talking, first of all, we want to take your phone calls. So 800-642-1234 on your money at WPR.org. This is a different email than the one we have been giving out all morning. So if you would like to email Kevin on your money at WPR.org, you can tweet us still at WPR Mornings. So Kevin, this scam, I'm really kind of intrigued by this. There's two different scams that we're talking about. How much money, who was affected?
Andy Thompson, Carrie, wrote an article in the Appleton Post-Crescent. We'll link to it at onyourmoney.com later on today. But he talked about two separate scams, but they were fairly similar. Of two cases of Wisconsin residents who took a bunch of money from investors, promising them fantastic returns, and turned out that they were alleged Ponzi schemes, and the victims lost several million dollars. Came from all over the country and in some cases the world. There were some people from other countries who had submitted money and don't have much chance of getting it back, apparently. And it was similar to other scams that have happened in the past and really, quite frankly, have been going on for decades.
Right. Can you talk to us about what is a Ponzi scheme?
Yeah, Ponzi scheme is basically where potential investors are told that this is a very safe investment, but it has really high returns, better than you can get anywhere else. It's not offered through a traditional firm. Often there's very little documentation in terms of prospectuses or in terms of statements before or during the actual investment scheme. And oftentimes they use affiliations that the victims have. They might be in the same religion or attend the same religious institution, similar ethnicity, where people feel like, well, I can trust this person because he or she is like me, or other people like me are investing in it. But then the money is often used for personal expenses for the person running the scam. And then as new money comes in, it's used to pay off the previous investors, eventually until it collapses and hopefully the person goes to jail.
So how can investors avoid becoming victims to these kind of scams?
First thing you have to ask yourself is, why me? Why am I so lucky with all of these trillions of dollars out there that are being run by hedge funds and mutual funds and pension funds and corporate accounts and all this money out there, these really smart people scouring the earth for these great investments? Why is this person allowing me with my $10,000 or my $50,000 to invest in this? So if you are at all concerned about the legitimacy of an investment, try to find third-party verification of the firm to where the money is going. You can look at state records to see if the corporation has actually been filed and registered with the state, or you can contact the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC.gov, and see if there are any other complaints against this person who is running this scheme. And if you have a trusted advisor outside and not connected to the person contacting you, this might be your CPA, your banker, an attorney, a financial advisor, run the information by them first and just say, does this seem legitimate and how can I know that I'm not being duped here? And if you do actually put the money into it, stay on top of the situation and make sure that you're getting constant communications and that it actually is legitimate.
So what can other would-be investors learn about putting money into these quote-unquote non-traditional or too-good-to-be-true
Yeah, non-traditional
true
in the worst sense of the word.
Right.
Yeah, this is actually a good insight to anyone who invests money with someone else through something other than, say, you know, a mutual fund or buying a stock or a certificate of deposit or even a bond that's issued by a corporation through a traditional investment firm. You know, a lot of times people come to me and they say, you know, I put $50,000 with this guy and he's flipping houses, or he has a restaurant, or he's got a manufacturing product. And I'm really surprised at how little documentation that people get on it. They don't read the information. And, you know, a lot of stock funds out there, like a Vanguard S&P 500 index fund, offers plenty of potential risk and return, but it's something that you can get into and get out of at a moment's notice. All the information is readily available to it. It's very liquid, it's very low cost, and it is legitimate. So whether you're thinking about investing in anything, whether it's an actual legitimate business or it's something that seems a little shady, don't put any money into this that you can't afford to lose. Don't put your life savings into this. If you write a check to some person for a business or some other kind of third-party weird investment scheme, kiss that money goodbye the moment you write the check, because then you'll be, first of all, you'll understand the potential risks, and second of all, you'll be pleasantly surprised with anything comes back with it. And just remember this, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor, certainly not these scams. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making an investment decision. So we're going to go to a listener who emailed us. She's a single mother, and she says she has two children at home. She takes home about $2,500 per month and spends about $3,500 per month. So there's a discrepancy there. She has accumulated $65,000 in savings from spousal support, which will end next year. She wants to, quote unquote, recast her 3.5% mortgage to lower the payment, but hasn't been able to do so. Should she use her savings to pay off her mortgage?
Right. Let's start with recasting first, because this is something that a lot of people talk about, Carrie. You're going to hear this sadly over and over again, is people calling in and asking if they should pay their mortgage off and me telling them to probably not do it. Recasting is a way where people actually go back to the bank and say, can we change the terms of this? If I give you a bunch of principal, you apply to the principal, keep the same interest rate for it in the same term, but then, of course, by lowering the amount due, I can reduce my payment, I can reduce my interest cost. But in this case, I would think that the listeners should not recast her mortgage.
Okay, and why not?
Because then she runs into a dangerous situation. It just feels like a good situation to have at first, but when a problem arises, it can be a big issue, because she will be house rich and cash poor. She's living on one income right now, and she has three mouths to feed, hers and her two children. And if she is like most parents, she hopes that her kids eventually go off to some form of higher education, so they have college expenses coming up. And if she loses her job and has no savings set aside, even if the house is paid off or the payment's relatively low, she may need to sell the house in a hurry if she can't find another job. And then she has to use the proceeds to find an apartment or try to buy a much smaller house, uproot the kids, maybe have to change the school district. It's not the end of the world, but it can be a really stressful situation. So instead, what I'd prefer is that if she loses her job, rather preserves the savings that she has on hand, she can slowly use the cash for the monthly expenses, including her mortgage, and $65,000 at $3,500 per month, that's the amount of savings she has and what she's spending, that'll give her about a year and a half to find a new job to help offset the monthly expenses, and she can still stay in the same home and then return to life as usual.
Okay, so she's got this $65,000 bundle here. What should she do with it? How should she invest it?
Yeah, if she is contributing to a 401k, she should continue to do that, and that should be relatively aggressively invested, because that's money, in theory, she's probably not going to need for a long time, maybe 10, 20, 30 years. But this other money that she has should be in rock-solid, safe investments, something that's very liquid. It might pay a little bit of interest, but more importantly, it's not going to go down in value, because she might need this, or more importantly, she's going to need it in 3 or 4 years anyway. So laddered certificates of deposit. Laddering means you divide up the amount of money that you have over a sequential number of years. Let's say you have $65,000. You might put $13,000 a year into a CD, one in maturing in 1 year, another in 2 years, another in 3 years, et cetera, until it's used up. And then you have access to the money if you need it in an emergency, but it's coming due every year so that you can decide if you need to spend it or you want to reinvest it somewhere else. And in the meantime, you're getting probably 2% or so on average now. Interest rates have come up on certificates of deposit in the last few months. And so you might be pleasantly surprised if you check your bank or credit union to see what those CDs are paying right now. And the great thing about it is, with a 3.5% mortgage and earning, let's say, 2% on the money, there's not too big of a gap between what she's paying on the mortgage in interest and what she's earning.
So you would advise her to keep her cash and not sell the house. I'm curious as to how she's spending $3,500 and making it work with only earning $2,500.
Yeah, I guess some of that is probably some of the spousal support, but perhaps the payments exceed what she's actually spending between her own income and the spousal support. So it sounds like she's been able to sock something aside.
That's good for her. Kevin McKinley is with us with On Your Money, as he is every Tuesday, giving advice. We have a few more emails, and we have some phone calls coming in. 1-800-642-1234 is the number if you have a question for Kevin. We're going to return in a moment. It's the morning show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Kevin McKinley is with us as he is every Tuesday to talk about finances and to answer your questions. We do have a question right now. Otto from Brookfield, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. Kevin, I am 81 years old. I have a rollover IRA and a Roth IRA. And with the taxes now lowered for the next 7 years, I wonder if it's beneficial to move more money from the rollover IRA to the Roth IRA. Most of this money probably will go to our heirs, and then they'd get tax-free money.
Right. Yeah, Otto, it's a great point, and especially it's very salient that you brought up that the money will go to the heirs or may go to the heirs, because the neat thing about paying taxes on an IRA when you convert some or all of the IRA to a Roth IRA is it's taxed at your bracket, and then no one else will ever pay any income taxes on it again, whether it's you or your heirs. And the question, Otto, comes down to what rate will this be taxed now versus what rate will it be taxed at in the future? If you think tax rates are going to go up in the future, it's better to make a conversion right now. Or in your case, your children might receive this money and during their peak earning years when they are in a much higher bracket. And they don't have to take it all out at once usually, but they do have to take it out over a period of time. And it might be taxed at a higher interest rate. And we're going to talk about this later on the show in more detail about the new tax code. But in your case, I would say try to convert whatever you can that keeps you with the 12% federal income tax bracket, the top of the 12% federal income tax bracket. And for married couples filing jointly, that's about $100,000 of gross income. For single filers, it's about half of that. So what I'd like to see you do, Otto, is add up all of your income. And let's say between Social Security and pension, you're probably taking required minimum distributions out right now as well, right?
Yes,
he says.
And as you're taking those out, that's, of course, tacked onto your income as well. But you can't convert RMD amounts, the required minimum distributions, to a Roth IRA, but you can convert anything above the RMD amount to Roth IRAs. So if you add up all of your income, say, from 2017 or your prospective income from 2018, and you are married, is that correct, Otto? Okay, if you're married filing jointly, again, it's about $100,000 is the amount that you can probably earn before you'll be above the top of the 12% federal income tax bracket into the 22% federal income tax bracket. So if you come up with a number that's, say, $80,000 of what your income is going to be, you can maybe convert about $20,000 from the IRA to the Roth IRA. But just keep in mind that sometimes adding that extra income is not just taxed. It can also preclude you from getting some other kinds of benefits. It can make Social Security taxable at a higher rate than it otherwise would be if you didn't make the conversion. And if you are planning on leaving this to heirs or whoever, you might say, you know what, this is their money. They can deal with the taxes. I'm not going to pay them.
Thank you very much, Otto. Kevin, we've got an email. Jane wrote, my husband and I are 68 and retired. We have about $600,000 in our retirement. We have enough money from our pensions and what have you for our daily expenses. We think we should take about half of our retirement funds and put it somewhere, as we are afraid of experiencing a huge downturn in the economy at their age. What do you think is the right move here, Kevin?
Yeah, it's hard to say without diving too deep into their finances, Carrie, but I'd say that could be a good idea. And it's not so much that I think there's some imminent downturn in the economy. There certainly could be, but we don't know that. And typically, the economy and the stock market often actually move kind of in different directions. A lot of times people look at the economic figures right now and say, gee, things are really good. Earnings for companies are up. Unemployment is down. Spending is up. This would be a good time to invest. And it may be, but typically those things occur at the peaks of stock markets rather than at the valleys of it. Typically, the valleys, things are terrible. And at the peaks, things are usually going pretty well. So I think that their fear is justified, but not so much in terms of what might happen in the stock market, but more so in their personal situation. A lot of times when I see people like this in my grown-up job, I find that they are invested in the stock market and they are very afraid of losses, and they don't need the potential higher returns that the stock market may or may not provide in the future. And there's one word in there in this email that was of particular concern to me, and that is their pension. And depending on the strength and the health of that pension, a big decline in the stock market could not only hurt this couple's savings, but it also could affect the viability of the pension for current and future payments. And they don't have any knowledge over where that pension money is invested. They don't even have any control over it because the pension managers are managing this for tens of hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of people. And most pensions, both public and private, in America are underfunded right now. And they're underfunded at a point when things have gone really well over the last 10 years financially. So imagine how much more they might become jeopardized if indeed we do go through some kind of asset decline. So yes, I think that would be a good idea offhand for the emailers to maybe slide some money over into things like CDs, Series I savings bonds that are very safe. They pay a little bit of yield, somewhere between 2 and 3% if you're willing to go out a little bit in maturity, and the money will be there. And if I'm wrong, the proportion that they leave in the stock market will do really well, and their pension will become stronger. But if I'm correct, they'll be very happy that they pulled at least some of their portfolio off of the table.
We are taking your calls today for Kevin McKinley for On Your Money. What is your personal finance question for Kevin? 1-800-642-1234. You can also email him onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Tom from Stoughton has a question for you, Kevin. Welcome to the program, Tom.
Morning. Yes, I was wondering, I'm trying to find a good fiduciary financial advisor, and I was wondering if Kevin has any advice on how to do that. I do have money in Vanguard, and I know that they offer, for my level of investment, low rate, or what seems to be low rate advisors. And I was wondering if it's a good idea to go ahead and go with them, or if maybe it's better to find someone locally. And, you know, how do you find someone with, like, a fee structure that, you know, is safe and not taking advantage of the investor?
Tom, it's a great question. And it's difficult to find investments that are safe outside of things that I've mentioned previously today already, like CDs and savings bonds. And just because you're paying someone to do that doesn't necessarily mean they have an insight to things that are still safe and earn you a high rate of return. A lot of times people are invested in things that they think are safe or safer, like bond mutual funds. And what we're already finding out is as interest rates rise a little, those aren't as safe as they were either purported to be or as we perceive them to be. So when you're looking for an investment advisor, the first thing I would say is I do like the idea of searching for a fiduciary. And a fiduciary means that that person has to put your interest ahead of his or hers, even if it cost him or her money. So they might, it's kind of like going to a mechanic and saying, I need all new brakes on my car. They're squealing. Mechanic takes a look at the car and says, you know what? You only need new pads and you only need them on the front. The mechanic could have made a lot more money by replacing your brakes. You were ready to pay for it. And the mechanic would have done better to do that, but still did the right thing and said, nope, I'm going to earn less money off you because I'm going to do the right thing for you. Now, just because you have a fiduciary as an advisor does not mean you'll necessarily be happy, just in the same sense that even if your advisor is not a fiduciary, you'll be unhappy. But at least there's a legal standard that the fiduciary advisor is going to be held to. A non-fiduciary only has to make investments that are suitable for you, but they may be things that are more expensive to you than you could get otherwise. And especially if you're familiar with Vanguard, I am a fiduciary, so I'm obviously biased in this, but I use Vanguard funds for the vast majority of my clients who invest in stock mutual funds, and it's because they're low cost. And there are other funds out there that might pay certain brokers more money, but I like low cost investing, and so I think that Vanguard is a good way to go. So I would do this. I would look around for different advisors, and the first question I would ask is, say, are you a fiduciary? And the second one I would ask is, say, do you serve people in my situation specifically? Do you serve retirees? Do you serve young families starting out? Do you do 401k plans for big companies? What is your area of expertise? And I try to find someone who specializes in your particular area of interest. And then I would say, what am I going to pay? How are you going to get paid? And what can I expect from you for those dollar amounts? You know, Vanguard does offer a relatively low-cost, fee-based advisory service, but you get what you pay for. You usually don't get to meet the person in person. You might find yourself going through several different people because they have a lot more turnover than a locally based financial services firm typically will. And they're probably not going to give you as much in-depth information as an individual to whom you're paying a little more will. Things about, like, should I pay off my mortgage, or I'm trying to pay for college, what's the smartest way to do that in terms of financial aid, et cetera. And then you probably want to go with someone who is fee-based, because they'll generally charge you a percentage of the assets that they oversee, and then try it out for a year. And after a year, you'll have a much better idea of your relationship with this person. You might find a good advisor, but the person might not be the right advisor for you. So that's the way I would go. Ask for fiduciary. See if they specialize in your particular situation, and then find out what they are getting paid and what you can expect for the services.
Yes, the Get Smart theme. It's time for smart assets. Just when you've recovered from finishing last year's taxes, it's time to start thinking about saving money on next year's bill. So what are the changes, Kevin, from 2018 in terms of taxes?
Yeah, the 2018 new rule as of January 1st brought several changes. And in general, the tax income rates decreased, the standard deduction increased, and there was now a $12,000 amount for single filers with a standard deduction, $24,000 for married couples filing jointly. There was a loss of some itemized deductions and exemptions. And most people are going to be affected by this somewhat, whether they have a home, if they're dealing with family investing or saving for retirement. And then there are a couple quirks that will affect a small portion of the taxpayer population, but in a big way.
So let's start with the home you mentioned.
Yeah, there's a cap on what they call SALT, and that's sales taxes and local taxes, property taxes, et cetera, how much you can deduct for that up to $10,000. Most people in our listening area will not be subject to that because they don't pay a high rate of sales taxes and property taxes, et cetera. There's no break for a home equity line of credit or home equity interest if that loan is not used for a qualified purpose. Typically, it's a construction or remodeling purpose. So, therefore, it's better, even more so now, to pay your mortgage off slowly and use any extra money that you have, sock that aside for future spending, because you are going to be less able to deduct the interest that you might use if you tapped a home equity loan or home equity line of credit in the future, especially if you don't use it for a qualified purpose. And again, if you have any of that money socked aside, a couple things you can do with it. If you're not maximizing your pre-tax saving at work, that's a good way to get a break on your taxes, by putting that money aside for retirement. If you are retired or you've already maxed out all your retirement savings or you think you're going to use that money in the next few years, then again, put it in safe, liquid investments like certificates of deposit and savings bonds.
And if you can no longer take a second mortgage to pay off your bills, to go on vacation, things like that?
You can take it the mortgage out. That's a good question. You can take the mortgage out. You just can't deduct the interest off it if it's not for a qualified purpose.
We've got Jeff on line one. Jeff from Madison, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. My wife's parents both passed away at the end of 2017, December 21st and 22nd. About 12 hours apart. Uh-huh. My wife is the sole beneficiary of their IRAs, and I'm wondering, is there a legal way to move these into our own retirement accounts or into the revocable trust we've set up, or must these necessarily be reported as income to us in 2018? What's the best procedure?
All right, Jeff, do you actually have, the accounts at a financial advisory firm or some kind of investment firm?
There is a financial advisor who was tending them for my in-laws, yes.
Okay. You can either use that person or you can go out and find one on your own if you don't have one. But what you want to do and need to do is set up what are known as inherited IRA accounts. And the money will transfer tax-free into the inherited IRA. But then it has to be withdrawn according to a schedule based on different life expectancies depending on how the beneficiaries of the account were set up. So you can't move them into your own accounts. You can't move the money into the trust unless you want to take all of it out and pay taxes on it right up front for it. And so you're just going to have to take a small portion out. Let's say it's $50,000 and you're 50 years old. You probably have to take about maybe 1% or 2% out this year at a minimum. And it's no different than if you were 70 and a half and dealing with your own IRA, that you have this required minimum distribution that you have to take out, and it is taxable as income to you. Now, there are ways that you can offset that by, you know, using that money to contribute to a pre-tax retirement plan or something if you have some room to do so. But no, there's no way to avoid it becoming taxable income to you. But again, the good news is you don't have to pay income taxes on all of it in the year you receive it, just when you take out those distributions that are required each year. And again, they're very small percentage of the actual value of the account.
Kevin, what about families? How are families affected by this new tax rule?
Oh, the new tax law. Don't save in your kid's name. That's not a good idea anyway, because if you have a minor child, you should keep the money in your own name. When you put the money in the child's name and Social Security, it is Social Security number. It's now the child's money. He or she gets to do whatever she wants with it at the age of 18 or 21, depending on the state in question. That number in the child's name also can reduce need-based financial aid, and it can be taxed. There's a new tax nightmare for kiddie tax where any earnings on that account are taxed now at trust tax rates, which are extremely high and kick in almost immediately on the earnings for it. So instead, if you're saving money for college, you probably want to use 529 college savings plans. Any earnings on those accounts are sheltered from taxation. The parents or the grandparents, whoever makes the deposit, keeps total control over the account. And if the money's pulled out for qualified higher education expenses, it's tax-free. And as of 2018 now, money pulled out for qualified K through 12 private school expenses are also tax-free as well.
And on the other side, not saving for college, but saving for retirement, what are the changes and how are they going to affect us that are saving for our retirement?
This is a little trickier. And what you have to do is you kind of have to bet on whether you think tax rates are going to be higher in the future or lower, and whether you think your personal rates are going to be higher in the future or lower, as we alluded to with caller Otto a few minutes ago. If you think tax rates are going to be the same or lower in the future for you, use pre-tax savings right now, like 401ks, 403bs, and IRAs. But if you think your tax rate or America's tax rates are going to go up, you're better off using Roths now, like a Roth IRA, Roth 403b, Roth 401k, paying the taxes on the income that you use to make the contributions, but then ostensibly having it be tax-free in retirement. And as Otto mentioned, you may even want to use this time to convert IRAs to Roth IRAs, again, only up to 12% of the federal tax ceiling, and that's about $50,000 and $100,000 for singles and married couples filing jointly, respectively. And here's an interesting thing for the new tax code. When you convert money from IRAs to Roth IRAs before, you could do it in, let's say, 2017, and then you could wait until you file your taxes. And if you didn't like the way the conversion affected your taxes, you could have a do-over. You could say, oh, never mind, I don't want to do this. I'm going to erase it. That do-over provision is gone now. Mm. So once you make the conversion in the tax year, it's done. You don't get a chance for the do-over on April 15th of the following year.
So there are a lot of quirks in this new tax law. One of the things that I noticed is that you cannot deduct travel expenses anymore, moving expenses. I just moved to Madison.
This was known as the carry provision,
yes,
actually.
Yes, apparently
they put it in.
So. Just this year for me. What are some other surprises that we're going to get?
Well, as you mentioned, there's the loss of miscellaneous itemized deductions, and we've gotten this question just about every week since we brought it up, but it's the loss of tax deductibility of investment management fees, meaning if you are paying a financial advisor, say 1% a year to manage your portfolio, those fees used to be tax deductible if they exceeded 2% of your adjustable gross income. They're not anymore. What you can do, though, is you can still pull those fees tax-free out of IRAs, and I suggest you do that. Also, if people who would take out a 401k loan from their job, they borrow against their 401k. Formerly, if they lost their job, they'd have to repay that loan within 60 days. And under the new tax code, they have up until their tax filing deadline to pay that loan. So if for some reason you run into trouble, you borrow from the 401k, and then you lose your job, you have until the following April 15th until you have to repay that loan. And then finally, for couples on the edge, there's a change to divorce alimony payments. Starting in 2019, next year, divorce alimony will be tax-free to the recipient, but not tax-deductible for the payer. So some people who are considering divorce have used this change to alter the way that we're going to go through this or the terms of the actual agreement.
So if I'm paying alimony, I will have to pay taxes on it, but my ex-spouse will not have to pay taxes on it.
Will be tax-free, correct.
We are taking your calls, 1-800-642-1234. For Kevin McKinley, we have a couple of calls and emails in the queue. We'll be back with more questions in a moment. It's the morning show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. As usual, every Tuesday, we're taking your personal finance questions for Kevin McKinley. Although I should point out, Kevin, you're going to be on vacation next Tuesday, right?
I wish. I am just going to be away from the office. I'll be on the road and working, but I will not be here. So you're going to have to try to figure out a way to soldier through without me.
We will get through. We will figure it out without you. Kevin, we've got some people who have been calling in. Don. They're still on the line with Don. Louise from Manitowoc. Louise, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I would like to know where to put the 3 months expenses that you're always saying I should save.
I like to see people have at least 3 months worth of living expenses set aside before they do anything, whether it's save for retirement, pay off debt, spend money on a vacation, whatever. 3 months worth of living expenses is usually about what it takes most people to find a new job if they lose their old job. And by setting aside 3 months worth of living expenses, it forces you to see how much you spend every single month. And hopefully you'll see some ways that you may be able to cut back as well. So it does double duty for it. A typical money market account, Louise, is just fine. You can also look at short-term things like certificates of deposit, especially if you purchase them at your local bank or credit union. You might be able to go longer than 6 months or 12 months or a year to get a higher interest rate, as long as the institution says, here is your, quote, substantial penalty for early withdrawal, unquote. Is it 6 months worth of interest or 12 months worth of interest? That's still pretty good, and that's worth that small penalty to get the higher yield until you might need the money and keep it insured. Some institutions, though, and I think this will become more common as interest rates rise, have what is known as a market-based penalty, meaning that when you pull the money out, we'll tell you at that time how much you're going to get. And if interest rates have risen a lot, you may get back much less than what you put into it if you're pulling it out early before maturity. So something safe like a money market account, CDs, and we talked about Series I savings bonds last week. That's another place that I would look as well.
So we have an email. Julie has a question. She writes, I'm wondering if Section 529 plans, which are the college saving plans, are counted towards your assets for purposes of Title 19 in Wisconsin. So before you answer that, tell us what Title 19 is.
Yeah, I think Title 19 is, do you qualify for Medicaid if you're going into a nursing home? And there's a formula that they use to see not only what money you have right now, but what you've done with the money in the previous years. You can't just give it away the day before you go to the nursing home and then qualify for Medicaid. There's what's known as a look-back period where they'll incorporate gifts that you've given away or donations or what have you. And 529 accounts, if you own them, are deemed to be part of the assets that can be used to pay for nursing home care before public assistance is awarded, because you can pull money out of the 529 account usually, and you only pay taxes and a small penalty on the earnings portion of the account. And since you are the owner of the account, it is your money, and therefore you have to come up and cash those accounts in usually before any public assistance will be awarded. So good question, but
so the state can say, take money from your children's college to pay for your nursing home.
Well, the interesting thing is your phrasing, Carrie. It's not your children's college. If the child is the owner of the account, I don't recommend that. But if the child is the owner, then no. As long as it is the deposit is not included in the look back period, then no, that money cannot be used. But then it now again is the child's money, and then quite frankly, the child is more likely to use that money on something that you wouldn't prefer, then you're likely to go to the nursing home and qualify for public assistance. If it's in your name and you own it and you're applying for nursing home care and you'd want to get public assistance, then yes, that asset can be included in that.
It's on the money this Tuesday in the 8 o'clock hour. What is your personal finance question for Kevin McKinley? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email Kevin directly at onyourmoney@wpr.org. You could tweet us at WPR Mornings. We've got Pam from Madison. Pam, welcome to the program.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you. Kevin, I own two rental properties, and I'm approaching retirement age, and I wonder how and when I should sell those properties, kind of to take advantage of any tax implications there might be.
Do you have a significant gain from the current cost basis of the properties, Pam?
Yes.
Okay. Are you selling them just because you're tired of being a landlord, or do you think you can get a better price for them now?
I mean, I guess I just wonder what's the best thing, how to think about it, I guess, is a question for you. Maybe.
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah, how to think about it is you just take the best price you can possibly get and pay whatever taxes you have on it, because typically capital gains taxes are, it's a much lower rate than normal income is at. One way in your situation you might want to look at it is talk with, do you have a CPA or tax preparer now that you use?
Yes.
Okay. Talk with that person and do a little strategizing and say, okay, what would the tax bill be today if I took it out, if I sold the properties, versus waiting till I retire, when you probably won't have a salary. You might be able to forego taking Social Security or a pension for a while to keep your income relatively low. And then you'd want to sell the properties in that particular year, because you might be in a lower tax bracket if it indeed does drop the rate at which the capital gains would be paid. So that's one way to look at it. That said, I'm betting with the appreciation that you've had on those properties, there's a little bit of concern of saying, hey, if I wait too long or if I wait that long to sell these, I might not get the same price. And even after I save the money on taxes, I'll still end up with less money in my pocket than if I had sold them today. Is that a concern of yours, Pam?
I'm not sure. You know, we bought these properties and they've gained in value, and we just don't know, you know, when to sell them and what to think about. So
yeah, if you like doing it, I have a lot of people who've come to me in the past and they say, hey, I sold a bunch of rental properties. Here's several hundred thousand or even several million dollars. Would you do me a favor and get me the same 8 or 9 or 10% return on something that's relatively predictable, like rental income? And there really isn't anything out there like that. And especially when it's individual properties that you know every little nook and cranny of those properties, you know the neighborhood, you know what kind of tenants you need to attract, and you know what a fair rate is to charge for the rent for it. And as an investment, they're really fantastic on paper. But I'm guessing, and I'd like you to just attest to this, Pam, if you can, for all would-be landlords out there, it's not as easy as just sitting at home and waiting for the checks to come in every month.
No, but it's been a fantastic thing to do. Just feels like a good exchange. You know, you work hard and have a nice property and you have good tenants. So it's been a really good exchange.
The first two words you said there, work hard. It's a great, owning rental property, whether it's commercial or residential, is a great way to get rich very, very slowly. Typically, you have to really luck out and buy at the bottom at a time, by the way, in which it's very difficult to get financing from traditional lenders. And you have to get in at a good price and then hopefully get in right before the boom, like any other investment. So if you like the investments, Pam, especially in this world, and you're okay with the work involved in it, I tell you to hang on to those for the time being.
Pam, thank you very much for being with us. Josie in Madison, welcome to the program. What is your question?
Hi. So we just bought a house. We bought our house before we sold ours. We had about a week overlap. And we had bought in a down market, sold now. So we actually made quite a bit of a profit on our house. And the house that we purchased is a bit of a fixer-upper. It needs a lot of work. And I'm just kind of wondering if we would be better off taking the money that we made on our house and paying down our mortgage and then taking out like a second mortgage, a HELOC, or a loan for the renovations that need to be done, or if we should just keep that money out and use that to pay the construction that needs to be done.
Yeah, Josie, congratulations. And I would definitely not use the home equity line of credit, especially if you think interest rates are going to rise, because home equity lines of credit are typically issued with a floating interest rate. And as rates rise, so will the interest cost of that money that you've borrowed. And so you want to keep the mortgage out there, keep it as long as you can. It's probably a fixed rate mortgage that you have, correct?
And pretty low, 4.5.
So. Yeah, that's a good yield, a good rate. Is it a 15-year or a 30-year?
30.
Okay. Yeah, I'd pay that off as slowly as you can. Use any extra cash that you have for the remodeling. And then I'd still say if you have extra remodeling expenses, as you know, these things can typically get out of hand and are more than you originally estimate, then that's when I'd go to the home equity line of credit to borrow against if you've used up all of your savings.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you so much.
We are taking your personal finance questions for Kevin McKinley, 1-800-642-1234. My mama told me you better shop around. Oh, yeah, that shop around theme. Millions of shoppers at Amazon.com use the Prime service. But with a recent price increase, should you be thinking about whether you're going to let your membership lapse or join at all? Kevin, what are you thinking about Prime?
Well, I am a proud or maybe embarrassed Prime member.
I am too, actually. I love Prime.
You're on first-name basis with the UPS delivery person? Right. Those boxes just keep piling up. Carrie, you and I are part of what Amazon says 100 million people worldwide who are Prime members, and we spend on average about $1,300 per month at Amazon.
I do not spend that much, I can guarantee you, but go ahead.
I like that, because you didn't say whether you spend more than that. You just said you don't spend that much. Yeah, right. Okay, so $1,300 a month on average for that, and basically it allows you lots of little perks and benefits. Well, there's a price increase that's going from $99 per year up to $119 per year. It's already been instituted for new members on May 11th, and current members will see that increase go up after June 16th.
So this is, Amazon is a strange thing because you actually have to pay it at one time. But really, it's only a couple of dollars a month, right?
It averages out. That's right. And some of the best advantages are there. First of all, you have a new member in your family named Alexa. I don't know if she's joined your household,
no,
Carrie, but
not
she's
yet.
In ours. And we make a joke about yelling things to Alexa, like, hey, Alexa, mow the lawn. And that doesn't work quite as well yet.
Mm.
It depends on your situation and what you're using this. What you're basically getting access to is unlimited streaming, music streaming, photo storage. You get Prime Video, which is kind of like a Netflix service. And, you know, a lot of times with these one-off Netflix services, the movies or the content isn't that good. Well, Amazon has fantastic content. You can get Downton Abbey on it right now. There's some other great series on there that really rival some of the original programming that comes from Netflix. You get private brand products, elements that Amazon is coming out with. But the biggest one that people most enjoy is the free two-day shipping. And what Amazon is really working on is same or even one-day shipping or within a couple hours. Right now they're rolling out same-day or one-day shipping in 8,000 cities on eligible products. And so all you have to do is basically say that you're out of paper towels in your into your Alexa assistant, and within a few hours, within a few years, those paper towels will be showing up on your front door.
Wow. So for people who aren't thinking, who are thinking about joining, who are not members yet, that $119 initial layout could be kind of daunting for them. What do you say to them?
Yeah, this might replace some of the other services for which you're already paying, like Netflix or Spotify or Pandora, if you're paying for photo storage. Amazon bought Whole Foods, and so if you shop at Whole Foods or a store like it, they're going to start integrating delivery of Whole Foods in your community sooner or later. There's a Washington Post subscription. You can get 6 months of free, and then I think it's only $3.99 a month after that, which is a substantial discount from what you'd pay for the New York Times or the Washington Post. Students can get Amazon Prime for a discounted price of $49 a year if they have a .edu invoice or email, rather. They get it for free for 6 months and then $49 per year. And a lot of people don't know this. You can share your Amazon Prime membership with another adult in your household as long as you're willing to use the same payment. So if you have a roommate, you can share your Prime membership, but you do have to use the single credit card. So you or your roommate has to put his or her credit or debit card up for this. What I'd suggest, though, is you try it out. Amazon Prime is $12.99 a month on a month-to-month basis, and then track your action. You can always cancel it if it's not good. And if you're thinking about canceling based on the price increase, cancel it. Go ahead and get rid of it. And you can always go back. They'll be more than happy to take your to take your money again to sign up for it. But keep in mind, some of the very early Prime memberships are grandfathered in, where more than one person can use it with no extra charge and with no payment restrictions. And the website Slice.com has an app where if you're willing to give them access to your email so they can see what you're spending on Amazon, then they will tell you whether or not Amazon Prime is worth it. For my purposes, it's not worth it for me to give them access to it, but you might like to do it. Slice.com is that website. We'll have that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
We have been talking about shopping around Amazon.com. Sounds like you are a convert, as am I. I think there are a lot of things I would give up before I gave up Amazon.
When they pry it from your cold dead hands.
Yes, exactly. Let's get to the website of the week here, Kevin. What is your website of the week?
Carrie, we were talking about scams. USA.gov is a government website, and they have a page called Common Scams and Frauds where you can get information to see if you have a chance of being ripped off and investigate things before you actually lose the money. USA.gov/common-scams-frauds. And we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com. Later on today.
Okay, and four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He is with us every Tuesday, though he will not be here next Tuesday, but we'll check back with him later. Kevin, thank you for being with us. On Your Money can be heard on the Ideas Networks on Tuesday at 8. It's also rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. The morning show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Brianne Sasho, Chris Molina, Laura Pavin, and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer is our technical director. Keely Boltina is the executive producer. I'm Carrie Kaufman, and this is the Ideas Network.